Are you all right, sir?
Of course I'm all right. Why? What have you heard?
I'm dizzy. I need a doctor.
Lucky Charms?
How are you so satisfied all the time, Abed? I mean, don't you ever want anything more out of life than cereal?
Sometimes I like to pour hot cocoa mix into cold milk and drink it like a cold hot chocolate. I call it special drink.
And someday, you will know it by its true name, diabetes.
Doc, tell me anything. Doc, quiet.
I think you might have to go to the nurse's office.
I think I'm losing my mind, Dr. Crane. People are talking to me through my radio.
Why do you think that?
Here it is again. There's nothing
to do here, so I'm just whining. It's bad that I even laugh at that. 310 on 580 CFRA, and I'm Rob Snow. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday house call, and it's great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Flu shots. By the way, we had an update on the vaccine itself. Health Canada, it says, has completed its review of safety information for the AgriFlu and FluAid vaccines. It's lifted the voluntary suspension effective immediately. All influenza vaccines are safe and effective, it says. And at ottawa.ca/flu, you can find a complete list of upcoming flu clinics. A small portion of the quota for the Ottawa area was effective.
They said 18% for Ontario.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the big debate is, should healthcare workers be required to get the flu shot? Make it mandatory that if you work in a healthcare setting, an acute care hospital, long-term care home, a practice like yours.
Yeah.
You must have a flu shot. What's your opinion on that?
It's part of the job.
But half the people aren't getting it.
I know. I can't explain why they're not. The point is that you do not want to become what we call a vector, meaning the carrier for infection into an institution where people are already ill. And the example I like to use, because, you know, you like to look for precedent to see if this is something that happens in other areas. Mm-hmm. Well, the precedent is, and I can attest to this because I have to sign the forms for it for people who come in to see me, are when people either go into health training programs or they go into childcare services. You know, they're running a daycare or they're working at a daycare. And I would ask parents out there, would you be comfortable, because what the daycares do is they ensure that each of their employees does not carry tuberculosis. They have to get a TB test. They have to be vaccinated, hepatitis B, regular vaccinations for common, you know, just your polio, tetanus, all this other stuff, measles, meningitis, and also to get a flu shot. So if you knew that the institution, or in this case, the daycare center that you were sending your child had people working there who were not protected from these diseases and could potentially give it to your children, would you be comfortable with that? And if the answer is no, I'm not comfortable with that, it's exactly the same process working in a hospital or any other health institution where you have people that can be susceptible to disease that can potentially be fatal for them. For the elderly people in hospital, they are usually complex patients. They have kidney disease, heart disease, lung disease, multiple disease conditions, and being exposed to the flu can kill them. And so the flu shot is not going to hurt the employee. The flu shot is not going to cause them harm. And they may want to protest that on the basis of personal choice. But if your personal choice is to not get vaccinated, then get another job, because your job entails protecting the people that you are working for. And if you're not willing to protect them, you're not doing your job.
Why do you think that there's so many healthcare workers who aren't getting their flu shot? What's going on there?
Well, some say they don't believe in the flu vaccine. They don't think it's going to be effective. Others say they shouldn't be forced to be injected with anything to comply with their job, that their bodies are their own, and they should have a personal choice. And to which I say, yes, you do have a personal choice, but if your job requires that as part of the process of protecting patients for which you're doing your job, then that's what you have to do. I don't see it being a big stretch to carry that argument further. So I don't buy the argument that we shouldn't, you know, you should have the choice on whether you get vaccinated or not. If you're working in an institution where people are sick, you have to minimize the risk of disease, just like you're supposed to wash your hands and do other health infection control measures. This is another infection
control
measure.
It's just amazing the number of issues in the healthcare environment. You know, a few years ago, it was just about that.
Yeah.
The number of people that weren't washing their hands or were working in the hospital. Yeah. And now Canadian Medical Association Journal says roughly half of all healthcare workers aren't getting a flu shot. It's almost inexcusable.
Yeah, I like I said, I don't understand the rationale.
Right.
You know, the first thing we do in our office is everybody rolls up their sleeves to get their flu shots. Right. So that's first thing when it comes in.
Do you make it mandatory? Do you say you can't work here unless you get a flu shot? Are you even allowed to do that?
It's not even a question of being mandatory. It hasn't come up in our office because everybody does it. I would have a problem with someone who didn't get vaccinated for the flu working in our office. And I would tell them so. And I would say that the thing is, you'd have to find out what legal ground you stand on.
Exactly.
Can you fire someone?
Could you fire someone? Yeah.
That I don't know. So I think in terms of contracts, you have to make sure under the contract that someone signs when they're coming to work that in there's a provision. And I don't know if the hospitals do that with their workers. Is to say that you have to have a flu shot every year as part of your infection control contribution to the hospital. And you're free to sign it or not sign it. If you don't sign it, you don't get the job. You sign it, you get the job. That's part of the stipulation. That's the other way to get around something like that. But I agree with you, Rob. It may sound draconian, but I really think that in this situation, it should be a mandatory thing, just as it's mandatory for I get patients coming, working, training to become nurses. They have to show that they've been vaccinated for everything. They have to show that they've been they're protected,
hey, even
not only for
dentist
themselves
office,
but for others.
Dentist office, you have to get all these vaccinations because you're working around bodily fluids. Yeah. There can be blood, what have you. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, and we know that the population, again, this is a population that we know with regards to the elderly, and let's face it, in our hospitals, it is predominantly older folks that are in hospital, that they are most susceptible when contracting the flu to severe illness and death. And it's a very high mortality rate if an elderly patient it's one thing if you're in the community and you're living at home and you're 65, 70, 75 years old, and you're reasonably healthy, it's another thing to be, which is still dangerous to have the flu anyway, but it's another thing to be in the hospital already sick and then to contract something else on top of it. It usually sends you right over the edge. Yeah.
It's so, a lose-lose.
Yeah. So I just don't understand it. You can't get sick from the flu. You can't get a cold from the flu. And people who say that they get sick afterwards, it's given at a time when people are getting sick to begin with. And the example that we've used before, Rob, is if you have 100,000 people at say today, and I gave 100,000 apples out to everybody, and 25% of them developed a cold or something over the next 3 or 4 days, you wouldn't say the apple did it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's the same thing giving the flu. You're going to give that, and the association is just not there.
Yeah. Let's take, by the way, folks, 521-TALK, star 580, 1-800-580-CFRA. Plenty of phone lines available for Dr. Barry Dworkin. Azra.
Yes, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am fine, and I hope I get the right... I'm looking for the response that I want.
Okay.
For MRI,
yes.
I'm getting conflicting information. Do we get radiation through MRI?
You don't. An MRI is a magnet. There's no there's no ionizing radiation, meaning that there's nothing that damages the DNA or damages your cells from an MRI. An MRI uses magnetism, magnets and electromagnetism, which is a form of radiation, but it's non-ionizing, so it does not cause damage to your body.
Thank you so much. I listen to your show all the time.
Thank you.
First time I call, and I got the response that I want.
Okay. You're very welcome, Ezra.
So there's no radiation with an MRI?
MRI, no, it's a magnet.
So what kind of imaging does involve radiation?
CT scans.
What about X-rays?
And X-rays. CT is a form of X-ray. So CT scans, X-rays, that's ionizing radiation, but very low doses. CT scans a little bit more. But you have to remember, when you're flying from, say, here to London in the UK, right, you're getting exposed to ionizing radiation in the atmosphere that exceeds that of several chest X-rays. So and people travel all the time. So it's a matter of thinking in terms of what the actual risk is. And there it raises a good point that you don't want to do testing unless there is clear evidence that the test is going to provide you with a benefit that will benefit the patient.
Right.
So doing tests willy-nilly on some mild suspicion may not be in the patient's best interest because, again, you are exposing them to something that is potentially harmful over the long term, especially if you do multiple tests.
Okay. Let's go to Jacques Saint-Sever. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I'm hearing clearly CFRE deep in Quebec near to near Three Rivers here.
Good.
Wow.
I have a question about my father was diagnosed with cancer, mm-hmm. Lung cancer, and he had the flu shot. I did tell him, that's in 1996. I told him, get the flu shot. You cannot risk having the flu. Your lung is not good. And he got the flu immediately after getting the shot. My question to the doctor, is it advisable? Do you advise people that have a suppressed immune system to get the flu shot anyway?
It's one of the indications for the flu shot. The other instance is that the flu shot cannot give you the flu. There is no virus in it. The flu shot are pieces of the shell that protects the virus itself.
How do you get the flu after you get the flu shot?
Well, you have to have been exposed. In fact, you had to have been exposed. And also, the flu shot covers certain strains. And again, mm-hmm. it is an estimate based on what happens on the other side of the world because the flu travels over. So you're determining what strains are causing the most harm and making an estimate of what's going to happen here. So you're never going to get 100% protection. You are going to have other flu strains. So what we tend to look at is flu vaccine that can vary anywhere from 50% to 70 or 80% in terms of protection, but that's better than 0% when you don't have anything. So I look at it this way. You know, you wear seatbelts not under the guise of thinking you're going to be in a car accident today, but you wear your seatbelts just in case something happens. So it's the same thing with the flu shot. You're doing that. So although his father had the flu, you know, I hear this all the time, but that doesn't mean that the shot did it.
Okay. Will in Ottawa, a question about quitting smoking. Will.
Yes. Well, I did quit smoking. It's been about a month, but I've had a really annoying cough ever since.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the point where it's affecting my sleep, and I'm contemplating smoking again just so I can breathe.
So this was 1 month ago?
Yeah, it was about a month ago.
Yeah, this is not unexpected. In fact, it's going to sound weird for me to say this to you, but you should be happy this is happening, and I'll tell you why. You are coughing because the systems that were normally wiped out by the smoking, that clear your lung out of all the stuff that's in it, are now starting to come back online. And that's why you're tending to cough a bit more, because you're literally clearing the hair cells that normally sweep the gunk out of your lungs and help prevent some bacteria from settling and causing infection and bronchitis are now starting to work again. And so your lung is literally, in terms of recovery, coughing out a lot of stuff that has been in there that it was not able to get out before because of that damage.
Well, and there is a lot of stuff coming
out. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
what can I do about the discomfort? My lungs feel like they're burning at this point.
Well, what I would do is I would see your physician, because what can happen too is if the airway is spasming and you have a bit of wheezing and it's uncomfortable, there are inhalers that can be used to calm things down and reduce the cough if it is a spastic component. But it really would require your physician to listen to your chest, listen to your breathing, even do a pulmonary function test to see how efficient your lungs were. But again,
how long would that last, the coughing
You know, you're looking at lungs repairing themselves, depending on how much someone has been smoking. But usually, you know, within 2 or 3 months after you stop smoking, things do settle down. Hmm. But it is interesting. And it's actually a great point that he's made with regards to when you stop smoking and things get a bit worse. It's only getting worse because your lung has been so dysfunctional for such a long time that you're just used to everything collecting in there and just sitting in there. So,
how long did you smoke for, Will?
Oh, I've been a smoker 15 years, but then I quit 3 years ago. And without this problem, then I got divorced and started smoking again.
Yeah.
How did you quit?
Just cold turkey. I just stopped smoking.
That's good. Yeah, and if you've been smoking a lot, again, it's cumulative, right? So although smoking for 15 years, then stopped, and then started again for another 3 years, it's still additive. So, but again, if you're coughing and it is causing a lot of discomfort, and discomfort also in the chest happens just because of the air turbulence, you're coughing so much, it hurts. I mean, you're literally tearing some areas inside the airway just from the air turbulence. And so that can cause some inflammation. So there are things that are available that can help you. But I'm glad you stopped. But the answer is that your lungs are working, which is the good thing. It's telling you that they're working. It's just the step that it takes for it to finally resolve and work well without the coughing anymore.
Okay. We'll pick it up after the news with more of your phone calls. So Leo, Joseph, George, Shannon, all of you, hang on the line. We'll get right to you after the news.
They had this special about, like, haunted houses, right? And, like, there's this one house they're talking about that, like, no one would go into. They were afraid to go in. They were, like, there were ghosts in there, right? And everyone's like, they're like, I won't go in there. There's ghosts. I refuse to go in there, right? And I was thinking, like, why is everyone so afraid of ghosts? Like, I've never heard of anyone dying from ghosts, right? Like, no one's ever been like, did you hear that Steve died? What happened? Ghosts. They killed him. I'd be like, really? I didn't even know that was possible. I'd be like, yeah, they ghosted him to death. Like, Lyme disease is more dangerous than ghosts, right? If they made a movie about Lyme disease, no one would be, like, terrified of the movie. Like, no one would be watching, be like, oh, my God, they're going in the woods with no shoes on. I can see where this is headed in 6 to 9 months.
All right, back to the phones. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday House Call on 580 CFRA. And Shannon, you're up next. Shannon.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have an elderly mom who has diabetes.
Okay.
And over the last little while, she started failing a little bit where I noticed her breathing wasn't, she seems short of breath.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be struggling not with dementia, but almost like she can't think of the words she's trying to say. She's mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
Her sugar is up and down. She can't control it. One minute she has to take a candy because she's too low. Other times she's too high. Can diabetes actually cause like the physical parts that I'm describing, the mental mixed-upness and if there's such a word, and the breathing problems, or is it something else I should be looking at?
Diabetes can contribute to that because, in effect, another word for diabetes is heart disease. They both, uh-huh, they're synonymous because with uncontrolled diabetes, you get what we call, well, you get vascular disease, meaning you get damage to the arteries of the heart, but you also get what we call microvascular or small vessel disease in the brain as well, where the vessels start to deteriorate and reduce blood flow to areas of the brain. And so, yes, you can have memory impairment and other types of changes seen over the long term in under conditions where blood sugar is not controlled very well. For shortness of breath, the same thing can happen. If their heart is failing or if their heart is not working well, another thing that can happen, especially in older individuals, is they can have heart attacks without any pain, and the only thing that they have can be shortness of breath. So there are instances where if you're seeing this collection of symptoms that has started either suddenly or has started up recently over several months, it really is important to evaluate all the areas that can be affected. So her heart, her lung function, because lung function can deteriorate. Uncontrolled diabetics also are at increased risk of developing pneumonias and other lung disease. So you're absolutely right in suspecting that diabetes can contribute to this, but it's usually a cascade of things that happens. You have kidney disease, which also can cause problems with breathing. You can have also with kidney failure, cognitive changes. There's a lot of stuff that cascades. It's almost a domino effect. And sometimes you look at it and you go, where the heck do we start in terms of trying to control this? It usually boils down to making sure the sugar stays stable. If sugars go too low, she can also have difficulty with memory function and just clearly thinking, because low blood sugar can cause cognitive impairment as well. And they're at risk of falling because they can get dizzy and lightheaded. So I would say that if she hasn't already, or if she hasn't gone already, that she needs to see her physician to do, first of all, the appropriate blood testing to assess how her sugar has been managed. Looking at her medications, because medications can be a contributing factor to some of the side effects as well. Some of the diabetes medications will contribute to low blood sugar levels, and others don't. So she may need to have that revised to prevent that from happening. But it is a relatively involved process to evaluate what's going on with her. The other thing that can be done if it hasn't been done, which is very helpful, is in conjunction with her physician. Her physician can make a referral to the geriatric assessment unit. There's a unit at both the Civic and at the General where they do home visits. They will evaluate her on the basis of the medical information provided by the physician. So they have all her information, but also they'll look and see if there's anything that can be done at home to maintain independence, anything that can be added at home to increase safety. So those are some of the things that can be used as a means of helping determine all of the problems. And also what they'll do is for each of the problems that they will list out, they will give solutions and recommendations on how to treat each of those. So it gives a good formal framework to give that help to her.
Okay, up next is Leo on line one. Leo.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I have problems. I get dizzy spells quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then I get headaches. And then I'd be sweating, like I'd be totally soaked from head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
And then my body would freeze and I would shake.
Okay. How does that, now does that happen all of a sudden?
It's been going on for about a year now.
Okay, but when the dizziness and the sweats and the headaches occur, is this something that just happens within several minutes, or do you have sort of a warning that this is going to happen?
Well, now I get a warning on the dizzy spell,
mm-hmm.
so I just sit down late, you know, if I'm walking or whatever, I just sit on the side of the road, so, you know, I don't, you know, get hurt or fall on the cement.
Okay.
And then the sweating, well, it happens a lot, like almost on a daily basis.
Now, are there any medical conditions that you have, any medications that you're taking?
No medication. I did blood tests twice.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing they found in the blood test they couldn't understand was the ferritin level.
Okay.
The first blood test was 3,590. And the second time I did it within 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
it went down to 709.
Okay. Well, sometimes high ferritin levels, though, that's really high if it was 3,500.
Ferritin is
an iron. It's a protein
right.
that carries iron, and it can be elevated under
conditions. What would be a normal reading or an average?
Anything under 300 is considered to be normal.
And it was at 3,000.
3,000, and then down to 700. You can have inflammatory conditions where ferritin tends to be, it's produced in the liver, that protein is produced in the liver, and so sometimes if you have inflammatory conditions, the iron level or ferritin level will go up for a short term and then gradually reduce over time, which is why it's gone down to 700.
Okay.
There's also conditions, iron overload or what we call hemochromatosis, that can cause this problem. But with regards to what's happening with him, again, it's not enough information to diagnose.
Right.
Some of the suspicions are if someone is headache, dizzy, feeling unwell, and it happens rather suddenly, that
sweaty.
That can be from hypoglycemia or low blood sugar levels. I'm not going to bank on that. I'm just saying that's one of the things that can do that. And a way to easily find out is when this happens is to take something that's sweet, so just some juice or something. And if the symptoms go away within about 5 minutes, you know that that's indeed what the cause was.
Right. But he should go get checked out, obviously.
That's exactly it. I think just in the interim, you can try that to let your physician know whether that helped or not, because that will rule that out or in. But ultimately, yeah, you have to see your physician about it. It's just not enough information to give a complete diagnosis.
Okay, we'll have to move along. Good luck, Leo. Joseph in Ottawa. Joseph.
Hi.
Hi.
I hope you can bear with me. My basic problem is arthritic, but I would appreciate it if you would have the patience if I were to give you the background starting in 1990. In 1990... I retired. I'm 77. I retired, and I got the flu, and I was administered erythromycin 325, and after belonging to the ATA, it was determined that it could be one of the contributing factors to my high-frequency tinnitus. That's stage one. Stage two, in 1994, I went to Florida, and I had a heart attack. I went to Southwestern in Fort Myers, and they determined that my left circumflex was totally blocked, and they performed angioplasty, no stent, in my right coronary. And then I read about Kowalski, a very good book.
Joseph, we're getting a little bit too detailed, and we are very short on time. In fact, we only have about 2 minutes left. So I would recommend you call back on Sunday when there's plenty of time. And I'm sorry that we just don't have enough time to get into all of that. Or you can call earlier next week. Ian in Nepean.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
I take Stelara for my psoriasis,
mm-hmm.
which has been very effective. But I understand that it's an immunosuppressant. And should I be concerned about taking a flu shot because my immune system has been suppressed?
No, in fact, flu shots are recommended for immunocompromised people. And the reason is that, again, there's no active virus in the flu vaccine. So you're not introducing a virus into someone who can't fight it off. In fact, all you're doing is stimulating the body to produce antibodies against the proteins of the flu virus. If you imagine the flu virus as a big beach ball with a pencil stuck in the middle of this blown-up beach ball, the pencil contains the genetic code of the virus, and the beach ball is the shell that protects that virus from being attacked. And on that shell or on that beach ball are grains of sand. Well, those grains of sand represent the proteins that you hear all the time of, where you hear H1N1 or H3N2. Those are those little pieces on the surface of that beach ball. So very far removed from the virus itself. But what happens is that when you inject those H's and N's into someone's bloodstream, you get antibodies to those. And with antibodies to those, it will attack that shell of the virus when it enters your body. If you're exposed, it breaks open that shell and allows the body to get into that virus and destroy it before it's able to spread. So that's how, in effect, how the vaccine works. So when you're immunocompromised, you're not going to introduce any disease. It's only if you give live vaccines, for example, shingles vaccine, you can't give to someone who's immunocompromised because then they run the risk of becoming ill.
It is amazing the number of people who have called over the last couple of weeks who wonder if they're immunocompromised, can they have a flu shot?
Yeah, well, I think it's because, again, it's the uncertainty of knowing what's in the vaccine, right? Everybody's saying just have a flu shot. So
right.
You have to explain exactly what this does, because the more knowledge somebody has, the more correct knowledge in terms of the evidence, the better off they are to make a decision.
Right.
So in this case...
But it sounds as though that if you are immunocompromised, you are encouraged to get a flu shot.
You are, because if you get the flu and you are immunocompromised, it's much worse for you.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yep. Great to see you
Good
again.
To see you
Thank
too.
You so much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Barry Dworkin and the Wednesday House Call on CFRA. He's back on Sunday at 4:00.